You can watch the video version of Coast to Canopy at wfsu.org/ecologyblog and the WFSU Ecology YouTube channel. Visit the blog for links to additional resources and related content. Over the last couple of months, North Florida has experienced an extreme drought. That's an official classification, D3, extreme drought. Governor Ron DeSantis has declared a state of emergency, and forecasters don't see an end in our immediate future. As a gardener, I don't have to look far to see the effects. I want to grow tomatoes and okra, and I want to create a habitat for pollinators and other Florida wildlife. But we've experienced some harsh droughts over the last few years, and that's not likely to change. Our topic today is building a resilient North Florida garden. This is Coast to Canopy, an ecology podcast from WFSU Public Media. I'm Rob Diaz de Villegas. Joining me today is Mark Tanzig. Mark is the Commercial Residential Horticulture Extension Agent for the UF IFAS Vion County Extension. Welcome, Mark.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Rob.
So, you know, I've interviewed you a bunch of times, and I realize I'm not sure I've ever really asked you, what is the extension?
Ah, great question. So, extension, you know, in Tallahassee, it's a little rough because we're tied to the University of Florida. But the reason being is that the University of Florida and also in Florida, Florida A&M University are considered land-grant institutions, land-grant universities. Part of that, part of what you have to do as a land-grant university is extend the information being researched and taught to the community, right? And so the idea is UF and FAMU will take information, get it to the citizens of Florida to help improve their lives. And so that's what extension is, right? Where a lot of times my director will bring an extension cord and talk about, look, there's the power outlet, right? That's the university. And here we are, the other side of this extension cord, getting the power to you so you can make, you know, decisions based on science, based on research to help do whatever you need to do. And so there's all the different areas. I'm horticulture, so anything dealing with ornamentals and plants and sometimes even bugs inside the house. There's also 4-H, which a lot of people are familiar with. That's the youth outreach component. Then we have family consumer sciences, which more into food safety and mental well-being and fiscal well-being. And then there's agriculture, which is a classic part of extension, helping farmers grow better crops. We also have natural resource agents throughout the state that help people connect to their local ecosystems and understand what's happening on in Florida's environment.
Gotcha. And every county has an extension office and every state has a land-grant university, right?
Correct. It's pretty amazing. So now every state does have a land-grant university. A lot of them are considered the ag schools. Okay. And they will have extension responsibilities. In Florida, we're pretty special. Not only do we have two land-grant institutions, but we do have offices in every single county. So you, no matter where you are in the state of Florida, you can find a UF extension office. Some states, you know, whether it be the original setup or budget cuts or whatever, have gone to like regional offices and things like that. But in Florida, we are really well represented. So Floridians all across the state can go find that good research-based information quickly.
Oh, yeah. And I find a lot of it when I end up Googling plants a lot, yeah, looking for good resources and trying to, you know, judge which are the reliable resources. And I find, yeah, a lot of county extension and a lot of just IFAS from UF directly. Sometimes I find things about our plants and animals that are from other states that are pretty helpful. Mm-hmm. I try to stay, you know, regionally closer, yep, on those because, we have the same bees. Sometimes like a common eastern bumblebee is, mm-hmm, in Wisconsin, but their resources, the seasonality is different, you know, things like that. But I find there's a lot of really great
We always encourage folks to go to their local office because if you're having some kind of issue in Central, South Florida, North Florida, if you go to the local office, they've probably helped someone with that same issue. And, you know, they're a really good place to start and get a good answer. The great thing about extension is for extension agents, we don't have to know everything because then we can reach out to the specialist in the various departments that can really give us the, you know, really, really, you know, specialized information.
Yeah. And as people come to you with different issues and problems they're having, are you finding that people are coming to you with more, what we would call drought-related issues?
Yes. Especially one big one that I think of is the impact to trees, right? So it's put stress on trees, and that stress leads to attack by insects. And so people are asking us, so the big one, we got a lot of calls, we still are getting a lot of calls about pine bark beetles, mm-hmm, and people are getting dead pine trees and asking what's going on. And so we have to explain, you know, unfortunately, there's not a lot you can really do to help that, especially once it's brown, it's kind of done. But it is all about stress. And drought, you know, leads to a lot of stress, which then has, you know, kind of ripple down effects for how people manage their landscape.
Right. As far as our gardens go, you know, we're planning, you know, for our native pollinator garden or our food garden. So we can plan a little bit more for drought directly on a shorter time scale anyway, that way. What's the best way, I guess, to sort of assess your yard and start thinking about building a Florida-friendly, you know, Florida is already a hot, dry state in a lot of ways, you know, a resilient garden.
Yeah, so I think we talk a lot about Florida-friendly landscaping principles, and there's a whole, you know, they can go to the website, FFL website, and see all these principles. But number one is right plant, right place. And so we're always encouraging people to really consider their site and what are the particulars about your particular site and your particular part of Florida, and what are plants that are just naturally going to do well there, so that we're not forcing plants into you know, not just the light conditions, but maybe even to a soil type that they're not adapted to. Because if we force something, that's usually where people start bringing out or having to use more resources, right? More water. They try to fertilize it. They try to, you know, spray it with some kind of pesticide to help. And so plant selection is really, really key. And the reason I like to talk about it's really important to the site and the location in Florida is that Leon County, we're a little different, right? A lot of Florida is sand. It's beach sand. Mm-hmm. I was just in South Florida visiting recently, and it's just deep, deep sand. Where in North Florida, we have these clays that give us a little bit of a different soil texture and soil water holding capacity. And so, you know, native plants, when it comes to plant selection, native plants are usually going to be a lot more resilient and tolerant of the kind of the variation in the climate. But it's important to remember where you are and what was native to your particular area, right? So lots of native species, Kunti is a really good example of a native plant, but it's native to South Florida, right?
Right. These Florida native species we see advertised in a nursery, right?
Yeah. Right. They may not particularly be native to Leon County or your particular part of Florida. So it's important to do that little research, you know, do some observations, go to local parks, see what's growing easily there, right, without any kind of help, and kind of try to get some ideas, you know, based on that really local environment around you.
Right. And we have some variety of habitat types in Leon County, right? Because we have, you're talking about the Red Hills, Orangeburg, mm-hmm. Sandy Loam, kind of. But then south of the Cody Escarpment, just in Leon County, we're talking about, again, sandhill, yep. Beach sand, really.
Yep. Deep sand. And then sometimes if you go a little further south into Wakulla County, you're starting to get sand with limestone right below it as well. So you get, you know, we have a very varied soil yep. textures here in Leon County. Yeah.
Yeah. And then we have like a kind of ravine-y kind of habitat. So some people live lower down on the hill and I mean, you know, in our area, if you go to a natural place that has that kind of habitat, some really cool plants grow there, but they're not stuff that I have in my yard, which is really high and dry.
Right.
Yeah.
And you got to remember a lot of these native plants, you know, they've adapted over long periods of time to these particular little spots. A lot of the native plants that we can then put into our landscape are somewhat more, you know, I would say kind of like generalist, right? They're not so particular, right? So if you try to grow trilliums in your middle Tallahassee, you know, downtown lot, you're likely, it's going to struggle, right? Where some folks, they just have them popping up in their backyard because they are in a, like on the edge of a ravine forest type of thing. So, you know, some of these plants that we're using in our landscapes, it's great to use natives. But again, some of these real, very kind of specialty native plants are going to be harder to pull off, right? So that's where we go with kind of the generalist natives that do well across several different conditions, soil types, that kind of thing.
Right, right. And so we're recording this in the middle of March. This is when I start doing a lot, you know, a lot of us are putting new plants in the ground right now. Mm-hmm. But it's been dry for a long time. And I haven't had any issues so far with peppers and tomatoes and stuff like that I've put in. But sometimes I do worry when it gets kind of really hot, dry, and I'm trying to establish new plants. What can we do as far as like, you know, what's the best way to establish a new plant when it's not optimal conditions?
So the key is good soil and watering in during establishment. And so that's where a lot of our soils, they're very low in organic matter. And so organic matter, things like compost, things like just leaving a nice mulch layer to slowly allow it to break down and create organic matter. that's going to be really, really important. So just starting with a good base of, you know, high quality soil. Then once you get them in the ground, you know, there's a lot of stress that goes on from, you know, first, you know, taking your plant out of the pot and putting it into your own soil. There's some stress there, some transplant shock, and you need to kind of baby it along there for a little bit with some really regular, frequent watering. When you first put things in the ground, it's frequent watering with low volumes of water. And then as they become more established, the root systems are growing out, you can, you know, back off on how often and then start giving them more water. But it's really important that first, you know, week or two, depending on kind of what you're working with, smaller plants establish better. So you might not have to baby them quite as long, but it's getting them established and then, you know, kind of finding that nice amount of water to give them, which the research has been done. And, you know, for most of your vegetable crops, because we're talking about tomatoes, peppers, okra, you like okra?
Right, right. I love okra.
You know, it's about an inch of water a week. And then you add a half an inch out for every 10 degrees over 60.
Hmm.
So there's an equation you can write down and try to, you know, get that amount of water to your plants to try to keep them going. With your vegetable plants, I always tell folks, you want those to remain happy, right? You don't want them to start wilting on you, because that's going to slow down your yield, right? That's going to reduce your yield. Ornamental plants, where you're not eating them, you're not selling them, they're just there for looks, they let them wilt a little bit. They can kind of work a little bit harder. And that's actually good for them, because they're going to, in those times of stress for them, they're actually going to put more input into roots, right? And they're going to try to grow their roots out more and deeper.
Yeah.
And that's going to give them a little bit more resilience over time. If you baby those ornamentals for a long time, and this includes your turf grass, they don't work too hard to put out deep roots. And so we get a little bit of a dry spell, or your irrigation system doesn't work for a little bit. And that's when you really start to, you know, they really start to have problems. And just like the pine trees, the stress then leads to other problems, right? So insects, disease, where you potentially lose them altogether.
Yeah. Talk about the root systems of a native plant. So we have sandy soils all throughout Florida. And I guess, you know, water just goes right through sand, right? So
mm-hmm.
Talk about these elaborate root systems. I grow the wildflowers in pots. And I realize after a couple of years, they don't do so well, because I think the roots just don't want to. They want to go further than they can in the pot.
Yeah, there's lots of examples of native plants, especially, that they spend a lot of the first couple years, where they're perennials, right, just growing a root system. If you've ever pulled those little laurel oaks out of your garden beds, you understand what this is like, right? Because sometimes they're really hard to yank and they don't come out easy. If you can manage pulling one up, you know, look and see the top part is maybe, you know, maybe 10 inches and the roots about, you know, 30 inches, 20 inches, right? So they're really investing a lot of time at the beginning into a deep root so that they can access the deep stores of water. When it comes to thinking of even perennials, these wildflowers, that's kind of a reason you don't see a lot of them in the nursery trade, is because they don't work too well in those shallow black nursery pots, right?
Right.
So the Monarch Milkweed Project out at St. Mark's Refuge, they did a lot of work trying to propagate native milkweeds. The problem they found is these native milkweeds were, again, putting these really deep root systems down. There's a picture of someone kind of trying to find the bottom of the root, and they're like, their whole body's in the hole type of thing. And they tried growing them in 4-inch PVC pipes, you know, like really long pots. But again, yes, these native plants, right, they're adapted, especially the ones that grow in the more sandy soils. They're spending a lot of resources at the beginning of their life trying to get these deep root systems started. And then they start to kind of, you know, take off up top.
Right. I covered that actually years ago, and they were propagating, was it Sandhills milkweed, which
mm-hmm.
is, you know, I guess you never see in nurseries, mm-hmm. but then they were also doing like the pink swamp and the Asclepias tuberosa, the butterfly
mm-hmm.
weed, which
mm-hmm.
which are available. So some can do it better than others, but when you walk in the forest, you can't just have all those plants in your yard.
Right. And if you're in a nursery business, you have to grow them in small little containers so you can ship them around everywhere. And, you know, these plants with these deep tap roots, they don't go well in those black pots. That's one main reason you don't see a lot of native species in the nursery trade, because they don't work well in those pots.
So you mentioned wilting a couple of answers ago. And so just to differentiate, because I've also seen IFAS put out things about, you know, late in the afternoon, your plants look a certain way, but they're not necessarily wilting, but they're doing something that looks like they're maybe a little sad from the heat. Mm-hmm. So talk about the difference in between wilting and sort of just a little heat relief.
Yeah. So, you know, plants are pretty amazing, and they have these little tiny holes on the bottom of their leaves, stomata. And that's where these holes are opening to let carbon dioxide in, oxygen out. And they have to open these stomata to, again, pull in that carbon dioxide so they can do photosynthesis and grow. The thing is, when they open those little stomata, water vapor leaves, right? And so there's like this pressure gradient, right? So the atmosphere will take a lot of that water. The water vapor leaves the little hole in the bottom of the leaf. That pulls up a water droplet or, you know, an H2O molecule from the stem, the xylem, right? We're going all the way to the root. And then that pressure has to pull that water droplet off of the soil as well. So when you start to get some stress, when there's less and less water in the soil that the plant can't kind of pull off of there with those roots, they start to wilting kind of is that stress relief, right? And there's sometimes you'll see it just in the evening or in the afternoon because it's the hottest part of the day. But that wilting is a way for them to, sometimes they're curling over those leaves to kind of protect those stomata. So if they have to open, they don't lose as much water vapor. It's actually why a lot of our plants have these fuzz, right? The fuzz and the, you think of a lot of the sand live oak by the beach, how it's got this leaf that's very curled over.
Yeah.
Right? These are plant adaptations to minimize that water loss through the stomates. So go check out stomata and evapotranspiration. It's a really great process to be familiar with. But wilting is that indication that things are starting to get hard to get water off of that soil. There's plants that we consider indicator species. So more shallow rooted species will start to wilt first. So in the landscape, common landscape plant that we think of is azaleas. They will sometimes be the ones to wilt first. And you know when the azaleas start wilting that the other landscape plants are probably going to be in need of some water as well. That late afternoon thing you're talking about is just kind of, that's just the heat of the day. And some of them are just like, okay, we're just going to like stop for now and slow down. We'll be back in the morning. So if you notice they're still wilted in the morning, that's when you know there's some problems and you definitely need the water.
Yeah. In my yard, I have a resurrection ferns growing off the back step. And I caught on to that because there's sometimes it rains, but it doesn't rain a whole lot. And I didn't water the plant the next day. And then, you know, but I started looking at the resurrection fern. And I'm like, you know, I could kind of go by that.
That would be a pretty good indicator. Now that's, you know, it'll go dry for a while. And sometimes they can get a lot more from just the, like this morning was very foggy.
Yeah.
Right. So they might perk up just a tad bit in a real foggy morning.
Yeah.
But yes, that could be an indicator plant.
Another thing is I interviewed a couple of foresters a couple weeks ago. They're part of an adaptive silviculture movement trying to figure out, you know, for forestry. And I found there's some things they talked about that I kind of related to the garden. And one of the things is that as you're managing forests, looking at maybe tree density. I have this bad habit of planting a lot of native plants close to each other and trying to get, you know, I don't have a lot of space. So I try to get as many wildflowers as possible. And I think that maybe taxes them when it gets kind of dry. Is that something to consider as far as how many plants you want to pack into a space or?
Yeah, you know, part of this right plant, right place idea is to properly space them. So it's always good to think of the mature size of these plants. You know, when plants are all kind of piled up against each other and kind of growing into each other, there's competition, right, for water. There's maybe, you know, some benefit at times there too, because now you have more shading potentially over the soil, right? So you lose less water from to evaporation. But in general, it's always good to kind of think of that mature size of the plant and make sure you give them room. It's really easy when they're little transplants to just like, you know, fill them up as much as you can. But you can see these kind of patterns in nature too, right? Where sometimes, you know, you go out into the forest, and it's a nice, even kind of, you know, usually it's a nice distribution, right? You don't see like a huge clump of something and then bare soil. But for the most part, when they're competing, when all those plants are competing for water, there's potentially some battling going on there for limited resource such as water.
So let's talk about, as a gardener, you want to build the experience, is I guess what it is, and observation. Mm-hmm. You're observing things in the forest and seeing how those patterns are. You talked about indicator species. Some species in your yard you'll notice do certain things at certain times. And then, of course, there's a lot of reading materials. So I guess talk about that a little bit, sort of honing your observation skills in the garden and sort of learning to read your plants and what they're trying to tell you about your area.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, I love to talk to people about just getting out into their garden, getting out into nature in general, and just being observant, right? Just the basics of science, right? Just kind of being out there and making observations. So spend time in your garden, right? Spend time in your garden different times of the day. Check it out in the morning, check it out in the late afternoon, even go out there at night sometimes and see what's going on. You know, why not? There's a lot of times, especially in your veggie garden, Rob, a lot of the caterpillars are going to want to munch on your plants in the evening. And then, you know, as far as like paying attention, are some plants performing better than others? Then start to, you know, make hypotheses of like, why is this one doing any different? You know, one thing, you know, not just thinking of your plants, but also what activities am I doing in here that's maybe helping, going back to the organic matter and your soil health? You know, what's going on here that's potentially helping? What kind of landscape practices am I doing? Do I need to change something up? Should I experiment over here and try something? Because, you know, your garden can also be a little laboratory as well, where you can try plants, try different practices in one spot and compare it to another and see what goes on.
So you talked about soil earlier. So soil health is really important. I guess, how do we make sure we have the healthiest soil we possibly can? Not every lot, we have our native soils, but a lot of our soils are disturbed areas too. And so they're not necessarily optimal.
Yeah, so soil health is really, really important, right? So I went to school, got a botany degree, and then I went back and got a soil science degree. And it's really the, you know, plants couldn't really pull all their amazing things off without the help of everything going on in the soil. So it really got me focusing more on just soil practices and principles and, you know, how we, you know, our management practices affect soil health. And the big one there is, you know, you're right in that a lot of our soils are disturbed, but if we can minimize how much we disturb the soil and keep it covered, right, with plants, with mulch, that's going to help. Because if we want good soil health, we want basically life in the soil, right? We want microbes. We don't want a lot of compaction. So especially in a vegetable garden for sure, but even in a pollinator flower garden, trying to minimize how much you're walking or traffic in there. Because plant roots, right? We always think of plants give off oxygen, but it's really important for plant roots to actually have access to oxygen because they're burning all those carbohydrates to grow roots. They need air. So these, you know, soil health, we want it to be alive. One great way to do that is organic matter again. So organic matter is the answer to a lot of problems when it comes to soil health. So again, incorporating compost, especially in like where you're trying to grow vegetables and fruit crops. But even in the landscape setting, you know, letting leaves lay, right? Think of the forest, of how it builds a healthy soil in a forest. Leaves fall, they rot, and that, you know, recycles those nutrients because of those microbes, right? And it feeds to that organic matter component. Another thing is to think of your fungicide use would be probably the biggest one, fungicide and insecticides. But, you know, a lot of fungi, a lot of microinvertebrates are doing a lot of this nutrient cycling. And so that would be one thing to consider as well, is right, those kind of going to scale back on some of those practices to allow the life of the soil to thrive and do its thing. Yeah. And, you know, sometimes we have to use these pesticides if we have a fungus in the landscape or, an insect taking out something, but trying to really be thoughtful and selective on how we use them. And instead of like preventative, right, just kind of confirming you have a problem and finding something that's as specific as possible to that problem. But with soil health, you know, it's you know, let's kind of let it be. Let's add organic matter. Let's not put a bunch of pesticides on it and reduce compaction, right? Make sure it stays like kind of fluffy, little air pockets can get in there. And they've been doing UF has been doing lots of great research in new subdivisions. So you mentioned how, you know, a lot of our soils are disturbed by development.
Right.
So they did a big project in the villages, which is really kind of interesting project where they are looking at the different phases and incorporating compost into some of the lawns, at the time of laying the sod or then coming back and top dressing And they're finding just some really cool results as far as, you know, the addition of this organic matter, kind of getting the life back into the soil. And they're finding that you can use less water, that there's less fertilizers needed, less pesticides needed for various things, because, you know, we kind of take for granted all these, you know, these critters, these microbes down in the soil, but they're doing us a lot of good. Really great research that they're doing down there, adding compost. The cool part of this, they looked at the undeveloped natural areas in the villages, and then they looked at the sequence of the phases and where they started adding, they looked at all these different chemical and structural kind of properties of the soil. And the plots that had compost applied, instead of taking maybe 20 years to get back to any kind of natural properties, it was maybe 7 or 10 or something, right? So they could really cut down the time it took for that soil to recuperate from that, you know, big disturbance.
Wow. And then you mentioned fungicide earlier too, and I was just thinking, and so there's microbes, and then just like a lot of a fungal network down there too in an undisturbed soil. I mean, that fungal network really helps all the different plants out. It sort of just really redistributes water and nutrients and
The mycorrhizal fungi. It's really cool. Kind of a lot of research recently into this and how it works. And yes, they found now if you're watering and you're fertilizing the plants, they found don't make a connection to the mycorrhizae fungi because they have all the water and the nutrients they need. So they're not going to give up any carbohydrates to this fungi. But it's, you know, as when we're talking about a resilient landscape, you know, these connections will become really important, right? Where this fungi kind of, you know, the plants give a little sugar to the fungi, and then the fungi help expand that root network basically and help provide water, and especially phosphorus was a big nutrient that it helps provide to the plants.
Very cool. When you talk about adding compost, I guess I always envision it, I always add compost to where I'm growing food plants and that kind of thing. And then when I have plants in the ground, I guess I don't add compost as much to just the ground, but I do a lot of the organic matter there is the leaves and then
that's perfect. Yeah.
Letting the plants go through their natural, especially wildflowers, right? I mean, and then there's these wildlife benefits as well for nesting bees. And talk about that a little bit, just sort of letting the garden, letting your native plants do what they would do if never touched them.
Yeah. Even your lawn, even your non-native plants, just, you know, the extension agent is telling you to leave it a little bit messy because, you know, when you talk to entomologists and you read up on the plight of insects, kind of all the groups are in decline, right? And that's not good for us humans because insects, they're the bottom, or, you know, they're not the bottom, but they're lower down on the food chain and really supporting a lot of higher organisms. And they're doing things like pollination, you know, really important for us. These insects need habitat, right? So when you look at why insects are in decline, it's loss of habitat, you know, their ecosystems, but also just, you know, structural things in the ecosystem that they live in. And that's where, you know, brush piles, sticks, piles of leaves, little patches of, you know, bare ground that they can use become really, really important. And when you have more urbanization occurring, you basically are losing less potential habitat for these insects. So if we can kind of think of ways in the little landscape that we manage to help things out, this is where letting it be a little untidy at times can be okay. Or if you can't handle a brush pile, maybe there's a shrub that you can like leave a couple sticks piled, you know, behind it, let leaves fall and, you know, try to leave them there or pile them up into the landscape bed with your wildflowers. Because these insects, you know, a lot of times we only think of them when we see them flying, but a lot of them are spending large portions of their life cycle in dead sticks, in the ground. And again, we need to be thinking about them because they're important to have.
Yeah, yeah. And years ago we had that, the bee project, bee in my garden days, you know, that we had. And we went to the extension and you showed how you could use dead sticks as sort of a border. So it's a design element as well. And then it's there, it's providing habitat, but also it's just decomposing and it's becoming the soil and feeding the soil organic matter over time.
It's kind of almost, you know, if you want to think of the forest again, right, where there's leaves falling, there's sticks anywhere, you know, kind of randomly distributed, but all that stuff breaks down and all those nutrients go back. We often tease that, you know, people bag up their leaves and put them on the side of the road. And that's like fertilizer in the, you know, that they're just kind of throwing away, right? Because those leaves will break down and return those nutrients. We even know with the, you know, on the lawn side of things, lawn clippings, a year's growth that you return those clippings back to the soil is equivalent to a fertilization. So, you know, there's lots of nutrients in that stuff. If you can handle leaving it, even if, again, this cues to care idea, something where instead of just having the leaves falling down all over the place, you rake them up into a nice shape, you know, whether it's straight or, you know, a curve or something, just kind of making it look tidy is all your neighbors need to know that, you know, you do care about things and you're trying to make things look good. You're not just totally, you know, kind of giving up on maintenance of your landscape.
Right, right. I want to talk a little bit more about mulch. So I'm talking about, you know, this important natural mulch that your yard is just creating. If people want to invest in other options, some of them, I guess, have environmental drawbacks. We did a podcast recently on a restoration project where people are restoring sandhill, and they're restoring it from what were pine needle plantations. And then, so basically, to grow these pine needles, you know, they're killing all this ground cover on these plantations. And so there's a lot of stuff you could buy, I guess, that has an environmental impact. But just in our yards, and then, of course, there's cypress trees, which can grow to be over 1,000 years old, and then you get cypress mulch. They get chopped down and for that. But talk about different ways, I guess, if people aesthetically cannot just bear to use leaves, what's an environmentally, I guess, friendly way of mulching that's also attractive maybe to different people?
Yeah, so that is a good point. And we at UF, as part of this Florida Friendly Landscaping, you know, mulching is one of our principles. And we do tell folks to stick with natural mulches. So, you know, you can find, you know, rubber, you can find some other things. We try to, you know, steer people away from that because they don't break down and give us that benefit of organic matter. We also actually tell folks to stay away from cypress mulch because of the, you know, problem you stated. They're cutting down these amazing wetlands to make mulch. So what we recommend is there are some issues with the pine straw.
It's
right?
Not because, everyone. They told us that there are some that you can source that don't have that, you know, that aren't grown that
right.
way.
Right. And it's true that in some of these pine plantations where they're, you know, tree farms, basically they're harvesting the mulch or the straw off of the in between the trees. And they do sometimes, you know, go through there and kind of nuke the plant so that you just get nice fresh mulch in your bale. But another good alternative would be pine bark nuggets. So the chunky pine bark nuggets. The research at UF has actually shown that it's the chunky pine bark nuggets and the pine straw that do the best for weed control. Oh. And it's something, you know, like kind of addressing your concern about, you know, the management of these pine straw areas. The pine bark nuggets are the result of, they come from the mill, right? So they're taking the mature trees to the mill, harvesting and making pulpwood. The first thing they do is take all the bark off the tree. Oh. And so this is a byproduct of the lumber industry. So that, I think that would be a good alternative. You also have, you know, some municipalities give away landscape mulch where it's basically they're picking stuff off the side of the road. That stuff is it's usually free, which is a nice little benefit. But it's usually chopped up a little finer, and that's the pine bark, chunky pine bark nuggets come out really good because that large size is what's really helping the weed control. But you know, even the free stuff, right? The price is right. It's a little bit finer, so the weed control might be less. It is going to add to organic matter quicker because it's finer. And then I think even like places like locally here in Leon County, Marpan Supply, right? They do a lot of the recycling. They take old pallets and basically chip them up. And so that would be another potentially, good source of, it's just a byproduct. These pallets are going to get thrown away. So that's another option maybe.
I have a friend who used to drive around and pick up pine needles on the side of the road. When people leave their yard waste out, you know, sometimes there's just a lot of good materials there.
Oh yeah, I mean the side of the road is a great place to find all kinds of things for the gardener.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I pick up leaves for composting from the side of the road. But if you see this nice bagged piles of leaves, you know, look and see what trees are in their landscape. If you want pine mulch or pine straw. You know, they got a bunch of pine trees and they're bagging it up. They just bagged it up for you. Just, you know, take it home.
Yeah. And I know pine needles, you know, I guess, and I had just learned about the plantation thing and where it might be, you know. But for in the garden, I mean, when we did the bee thing, it's one thing we went out in the forest with Lily Anderson Messick, and she was saying, well, this is actually, you know, most of the bees in our area nest under this natural mulch as opposed to a hard chipped up wood where, you know, it's harder for a bee to get underneath. And so just for habitat that way.
Yeah. The other issue, sometimes if you have, so like you mentioned, your, you know, almost like a native wildflower patch, if you want these things to reseed, that's where you may not want to use the chunky pine bark nuggets or a real dense layer of mulch, because they'll get kind of caught up in that mulch and won't sprout, right? So if you have a garden that you want to reseed, you want to try to keep a very thin layer of mulch there so that actually those seeds can get down into the soil. Another issue that people have talked about with the pine straw that's potentially a little, you know, concerning is a lot of times, especially climbing fern. We have this old world climbing fern. That it's a fern, so it spreads by spores. Some of these tree farms, you know, have this climbing fern in the tree farm, and so sometimes you will get some volunteers out of this pine straw that you may not want. You know?
So we have some non-native species that might be, especially lawn ornamental plants that, you know, might be rated for sort of our climate zone and that tend to do well here. I mean, is there any reason we couldn't just use those instead of native plants? Or what's the additional benefit of a native plant in our ecosystem?
That's a good question. Native plants, there are several benefits. They're adapted to the climate. They're adapted to the soil. And even in a changing climate, you know, you think of these native plants, they've adapted here for thousands and thousands of years, right? So they've been through some cycles even of climate change. And you know, a lot of these plants will kind of, they'll migrate a little bit, right? They'll move and they'll kind of come back down. So these plants are just well adapted to the climate, the soils, the pests, insects and diseases. The big advantage to native plants, especially for wildlife lovers, is again, supporting all the insects and the native wildlife. Again, these native plants, they've adapted a long time. They've been here. They've adapted to these insects. These insects are now feeding, and they're specializing so oftentimes on some of these plants. And then again, those insects are what's feeding the birds, you know, mammals, all these kinds of, you know, other critters out there. Non-native species, the one kind of, I guess, in talking to a lot of folks, the one issue with native species and the reason we go to a lot of non-native plants is the showiness, right? So a lot of the non-native plants, those are the big flowery things that we like to plant, right? We like to see them in the landscape. I mean, there's plenty of natives. And as a botanist, even the tiny little flowers, I'm like amazed by a lot of our native plants. But when you're just talking about, you know, plants driving down the highway that are going to be in parking lots, these folks are looking for, like, you know, easy to grow, bloom, look really pretty. And so a lot of those tend to be non-native plants. Again, the non-native plants, they're not adapted to our pests and disease, so they, you know, sometimes need a little help there. They don't feed native wildlife in general. Now, there are some there are some non-native species that are beneficial, and if you kind of are on this native plant side of things, but you maybe want some showy things, or you want to add some other species to just get more diversity in your landscape, you know, there's plenty of examples of non-native plants that are really beneficial to pollinators, to other mammals. But it's, you know, being really careful to make sure we're not getting anything that's an invasive species.
Yeah.
That's really the main thing. Making sure they're well-behaved non-natives and that they provide something to wildlife is really important, especially when urbanization is happening very quickly. You know, we're losing natural habitat to either agriculture or urbanization. So making sure that we are helping out these critters in our landscapes, in our urbanized areas, is really, really important. So if you go with non-natives, look for something that is either going to feed you or is going to feed some wildlife.
Yeah. I think some people, I think even my own wife, I think we have differences in opinion of how beautiful native wildflowers are compared to maybe some other non-native options. I think one thing that could help perhaps is just sort of thinking about seasonality, because then you have things that bloom at all times of the year, that kind of thing. And maybe, you know, you buy a thing and it only blooms for like half a month or a month or 2 or 3 months out of the year.
Yeah, I mean, it's always great to have just a lot of diversity in your landscape, right? Because the flowering times can be different. the uses of different parts of those plants could be different amongst the seasons and amongst species. And not only thinking of just like the diversity of individual species in the landscape, but the really important thing when it comes to wildlife utilization is that diversity in vertical layers, right? So like this, the structure of your habitat, of your landscape, you know, the more vertical layers, right? The more, you know, down low, kind of in the middle, you know, kind of high and then really high, right? These, you know, having as many of these layers filled in as possible, throw some vines in there, ground covers, you know, this really increases the ability for insects to utilize your landscape. And even birds, right? If you think of birds, they have their different little niche that they like. So in ecology, right, this is the niche idea. And so by providing all these layers, you provide more niche habitat for, you know, the most species as possible to utilize.
When thinking about resilience, you talked about, you know, how some of these species, you know, especially during like this, the end of the Pleistocene, they were moving up and down maybe a little bit as the temperatures changed. Do we think we want to start looking at maybe some species that are just a little further south in the peninsula to see if they would work here okay? And some are already kind of migrating, perhaps.
Yeah, I mean, some plants are migrating. Native plants and invasive species are slowly moving north. But, you know, so we've had one thing we know about climate change is that it's happening, first of all, and that it's a little, it's variable, right? So we have gone, we're in March here in Leon County. We were just that, we had a pretty cold winter. Last year we had ice on the ground for several days. And now within like 2 weeks of being, you know, in the, you know, 30s at night, we're having like 90 degree days, right? Like record heat. And then in a couple days from now, we're supposed to go down into 30s again. So the variability is all over the place. And so the one concern about picking things that are a little more to the south of us is still we're going to get cold snaps that are going to knock them back. And so what I would say, you know, instead of, you know, like maybe looking at the range, you know, you can often find what's the range of the species that you're looking at. And, you know, making sure that we're a little bit in the middle, right? The range goes above and below us quite a bit. And as far as some plants you might want to avoid are actually species where the range just goes a little bit south of us. So dogwood trees are a really good example of a native species that are kind of getting stressed out by climate change and the warming temperatures. You know, we're already kind of at the southern end of their range. And so they're kind of getting pinched out, right, by these this warming climate. So, you know, not to go too far south, because, again, we're going to get these cold snaps that are going to knock things back. And so I was, again, I was just driving down south, coming back up the turnpike. And I saw where folks near Orlando were planting lots of royal palms, right, which are, you know, really great South Florida landscape plant. And they're just all brown, right? Mango trees that were just all browned out because you know, we get excited. The USDA hardiness zone was just changed a couple of years ago. So we're in 9A now instead of 8B. And of course, people start asking, you know, can we start growing avocados and mangoes and, you know, guava and all these things? And I'm like, look, don't, I tease, you know, don't start planting mangoes quite yet, because while we are warming, you know, we're going to have these cold snaps and this kind of extremes almost, right, where we're going from, you know, we're really warm, then we're really cold, and we need to find things that are kind of resilient to both of those conditions. And the native species, again, that have been through this, right, for our area are most likely going to be able to handle that pretty, you know, they're going to be able to take it a little bit better.
I find it, since I have a lot of native plants, that there's not a lot of plants I cover necessarily when it gets freezing. I have like my food plants I want to keep, and even some of those are kind of cold hardy. But, and some of them, I think observationally, maybe it's just me, seem to do better. They reseed more, maybe, it seems to me sometimes. So I got my pink swamp milkweed is getting really tall all of a sudden, and we're like in not quite the middle of March just quite yet. I don't know.
But yeah, I mean, a lot of people, when we start to get these cold snaps, you know, they freak out and they call the extension office and they want to know what to cover and they're concerned about this and that. And I'd like to, when I give presentations on this, I say, look, if you follow right plant, right place, you won't have to worry so much. I mean, people are very concerned. I mean, they're almost in tears wanting to know what to do with these various plants. And, you know, if you just went with right plant, right place, you wouldn't have to worry so much about this, right? They can handle the cold. You don't have to cover everything in the landscape. sure, you might have some special edible plants or some, you know, might want to play around with some tropical type things every now and again. But for the most part, if you follow the right zone and the right plant, right place type of idea, the stress goes way down for yourself and for your plants. Yeah.
All right. So I want to shift back to water. So, okay. You know, we talked about watering the plants, but, you know, in our gardens, there's different things we can do to maybe capture water. Talk about, I guess, rain gardens and rain barrels and things we can do to sort of get water into the system in different ways.
Yeah, those are really good ways. I'm going to go back again and hit up organic matter because organic matter is really, really important. And organic matter adds to the water holding capacity of the soil.
Right.
Especially if you have sandy soils, the sand just doesn't hold very much, doesn't have a lot of surface area to kind of hold on to water molecules. So organic matter does, and that's a really good way. So increasing that organic matter, using the mulch, right, keeping the water in the ground for as long as possible. But then we can use rain barrels, especially would be great, right? Because then you can save water falling off your roof and you can use it in your garden, right? It's very straightforward, right? You're going to save water. And here we're allowed to do it. A lot of people ask, is this like legal to do in Florida?
Right.
Because there's some places out west where it's actually illegal to capture water that falls off your own roof, right? The water has to continue going downstream. But here, you know, it's legal to capture rainwater. Of course, this is non-potable water. So, you know, you wouldn't want to use it for any eating or consumption by humans, but it's perfectly fine for the landscape. Rain gardens are really beneficial in trying to make sure that we reduce the amount of water flowing off of our site and get that water into the ground close to where it falls is the idea there. You know, you can make these little depressions. I kind of tease it sometimes. It's like a big mud puddle is what you're building, right? It's this big, huge mud puddle. But that's where you could add some, you know, plants that can handle being inundated for a day or two, and then they go back dry. So there's lots of like muley grass, lots of grasses that do well, irises. But if we're in a long-term drought, your rain garden will be quite dry for a while.
Yeah.
But that's where the rain barrels are really helpful, right? Because you can, you know, you'd be surprised how quickly a 50-gallon drum will fill up.
Yeah,
just catching what falls off the edge of the roof, not even connected to a downspout. And they're pretty easy to find and make your own. And I mean, it can be as simple as a big old trash can that you just stick under the overhang of the roof and catch a good amount of water.
Yeah. And now Ivy Urquhart is joining us. Ivy's an IT major at Florida State University and a DJ on V89. And this semester, she's joined WFSU Public Media as an FSU Sustainable Campus Fellow. Her project is related to No Mow March here in Innovation Park, which is where WFSU is located. So, Ivy, can you describe like these areas that we have for No Mow March that we've been gifted by FSU groundskeepers?
Yeah, definitely. Well, one is very close to home, right near WFSU in our like side yard sort of area. It's our smallest of the three, I'd say. But it's interesting that you can see the different species between the three of them, even like just being close to like WFSU, we have way more like lyreleaf sage. We don't really see that in any of the other two plots, which I feel like is very interesting.
Yeah, we have more trees in this one too, because it has some pines and oaks and things on the side there.
Yeah. So similarly, we see a lot more of our mining bee burrows, which I think is very cool. The second is right across the street. It's at a droughted retention pond that we have over there. Which is our second biggest, and it has these like very nice slopes on all sides that have even more growth left over. I think they weren't mowing it prior either. There's some cool cypress trees in there, very cool. And then the third is my favorite. It's actually quite giant. It's quite expansive. It's far out on the other side of the park, and it has this giant mass of dewberry in one of the corners that we had good pollinators on last week. Yeah,
and God, the mining bees too. So I was just going to let you know, I was walking at lacrosse stadium we have next door, which they just built. They just planted some rows of grass, but there are thousands upon thousands of mining bees on the other side. So what we have here is the edge of a really huge colony of mining bees. But what's over on the other side is, maybe if you want to walk there, you see it. It's insane. You just walk and walk and walk, and they're really close together as opposed to how they are here.
Yeah.
So we're doing these no-mow areas. So, Mark, you were on our very first episode of Coast to Canopy, which was about No-Mow March. real briefly, not to recap that whole episode, as we did that episode already, but just really briefly, what is NOMO March?
So NOMO March is this effort that we started at the UF IFAS Extension office here in Leon County, and it's actually spread to some other counties to the north, and even some in Central Florida have started to pick it up and promote it. But the idea is to basically, it's real simple, right? You just skip mowing, and you can do the whole yard if you want to, but at least part of the yard. And the idea is that you're going to let some of these, you know, what a lot of people consider weeds, these winter annual plants, kind of finish off their blooming. And why this is really important is there's lots of insects that are coming out of their little winter paws, and they need floral resources, right? They need nectar, they need pollen. And these winter weeds, you know, are really great resources before all of our, you know, the ornamentals and a lot of the other native species come out and fully start to bloom. So it's just an important way to get provide some habitat for insects, but also to get people thinking about how their landscape practices affect the greater world around them and the organisms that are here sharing the, you know, sharing this place with them.
Yeah, yeah. So what kind of things are we seeing in our NOMO areas? Or you've mentioned a couple. The dewberries, I remember, were really impressive last week.
Yeah.
Especially there's this little area with a few little shrubs and trees, and amongst them, and it's just full of pollinators. So what are the kind of things are we seeing that you find interesting?
Yeah, there's this, this doesn't have a huge bearing on the pollinator cycle, I imagine, but there's this, it's a moss, it's the cow long hair moss or something that we have all around Innovation Park. And it's very beautiful to video, just as like a general, because I, in this project, kind of want to engage people's like curiosities about even just like what could be in their own backyard, even divorced from the benefits to pollinators that NOMO can have. So even just pointing out stuff like that, I think is very cool. We also have seen some vetch, which isn't native, very beautiful. There's another giant patch of that that always has a ton of carpenter bees on it, which are my favorite because they're the easiest to photograph because they're very slow and they're very big.
They don't really care about people getting up close to them.
They don't care about that. Yeah. Also adorable. What else have we seen out there?
So you mentioned vetch. And there's a lot of clover, too. A lot of these are kind of agricultural cover crops.
Yeah.
So, you know, great thing that you mentioned was getting people just excited about making observations of what's out there too, right? So we promote the pollinator habitat and insects, you know, resources. But my big thing, I'm a botanist, right? My background is plants. And so I love people just learning about all these things that are right there, right? Right in front of you. So much diversity, right? And that's why, you know, I kind of started NOMO, you know, March and April and other things a long time ago. Because I just love all these plants. So, you know, finding these great species nearby, some of them aren't native, but, you know, the big thing we're concerned about, there's lots of plants that are not native that thrive in these disturbed urban environments, but they're not considered invasive species, right? They're not going to jump into a natural setting and just kind of like take over like a kudzu type deal. So, you know, the clovers, the vetch, you know, there are plenty of non-native species that are really valuable to insects. And in those cases, in an urban setting where there's lots of disturbance has gone on in the soil and for the plant life, you know, these things provide value, right? So clovers, vetch, both legumes, add nitrogen to the soil, help all the other plants, even the lawn grass that people might be really concerned about, you know, help them thrive a little more without adding, you know, fertilizers to the soil.
Right.
And the dewberries are great. You just keep an eye on those dewberries because then you'll have these wonderful blackberries in maybe a couple of weeks, right? So keep those nice patches of dewberries in your mind.
That's so exciting.
And go find them later.
Food for us and food for mammals
it's
as well.
Amazing.
Yeah.
I'll be on the field and I'll just start foraging.
Yes.
Snack.
Yeah.
So for people that, the idea of the campaign is to get people at home following along in their NOMO, but once March ends, how should people know whether or not to continue NOMO, and how do you think they should continue with that?
So, you know, there's challenges when you stop mowing for a month in Florida. And the reason we this whole NOMO idea started in England and then moved to the United States, and it was NOMO May is the month they went with. But you can imagine doing that in Florida, it would be insane, right? The biomass created by your plants and your lawn would be a bit too much for your lawnmower to handle once, you know, the next month came along. So we chose March because, again, for us, that's when the insects are kind of coming out of dormancy. That's when a lot of these winter weeds are best providing those resources for them. We don't want people to just forget caring about insects and lawn practices and how it affects wildlife at, you know, come April. So what you do when it's over is you can decide if you want to just keep it going. The aesthetics start to bother a lot of people, right? And that's where, again, you don't have to do the whole lawn. It can be just a piece. And so you could mow some of it to kind of something that is in the research, the literature when it comes to these types of things is these cues to care. So you can mow little patches and mow like sharp lines to let people know that you're actually trying to maintain your landscape and you're not just trying to like, you know, just abandoning the property or anything. And the one thing that will happen if you leave it too long is woody species start to come up in those patches, right? So if you don't want pines and kind of some laurel cherries and, you know, other kind of shrubby, maybe somewhat weedy native species to come up and you want to keep it more of like a meadow look, right? That's where you would then maybe just go back to mowing, but maybe on an infrequent cycle, right? So maybe every other week, maybe just once a month, depending on what you're comfortable with and what your lawnmower can handle, especially as we go into the summer months and, you know, it doesn't take long for the mower to get bogged down pretty quickly. So, you know, you could leave big patches. I got a couple of big patches that I leave for big parts of the year, but then you're going to have to go in there and you're going to have to hand pull some of the woody species that are going to try to, you know, succession's going to occur in those little patches.
And then going into late March and into early April, because I believe we have our patches claimed no mow until like late April.
Mid-April, late April, yeah. Right. We'll discuss, great, I guess, with them.
Yeah.
See how long they'll let you do it.
Yeah. What species do you think I should be looking for when educating people about what they should be looking for? Because I don't have an ecology background. Are there any like significant species around that time?
One thing that usually shows up at the very end of March or going into April that I love finding in my own yard is Spiranthes orchid. And so there's a native orchid that's called Spiranthes. I can't remember what the common name is, but the genus is Spiranthes. And it makes sense because the flowers come in this tight spiral on the top of the plant. I mean, it's only this tall. It's little white flowers. And that's my favorite one to catch towards that end of the no-mow March going into April season. So look out for that one. It's gorgeous. And it's a neat native orchid. I mean, so.
That's extremely exciting.
Yeah, great.
I think I've seen some on our lawn when they let it happen. Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's a few. They're very thin and hard to
very
see
thin.
Almost unless you kind of get up on them, right?
Yep. So when it comes to mowing, when I start mowing, because, you know, we have, you got to keep up appearances a little bit, right? So my wife, she'll be like, hey, you know, it's not March anymore. You're going to keep the things mowed a little bit. Like, sure. And I'm out there mowing around these, you know, clumps of Spiranthes orchids. To make sure I don't run them over because I want them to go to seed. And so, you know, these plants, the important thing is to try, if you want them to following season, let them go all the way out to seed so that you, a lot of them are annuals, right? So that mother plant this season is going to die back and you need those seeds in the seed bank to come up next year.
And how can people tell when plants do go to seed? Because I feel like that's like the phrase used often, but like...
It's hard to tell.
How do you know?
So first comes the flower, right? So you'll see the blooms and you just know to wait. And this goes back to your observation part, right? Like keep going out there and monitoring, observe, scout. Look and see what happens after those dewberries, you know, the petals fall off. And then you'll start to see some kind of a fruit going there. And then for sure, the sign for most of these species is when you grab that little fruit, kind of break it up in your hand, and the seeds just kind of fall out, right? And so that's how you know for sure it's gone to seed. You can, you know, go through and like take a rake or just your feet and kind of make sure you knock up plenty of those seeds off. So in your case, before FSU is like, look, we're going to mow this stuff down, you go out there and you knock a bunch of those seeds down. Yeah.
Slapping all the plants.
And then they can mow them all down and, you know, they'll be back next year.
Yeah, so, I mean, for the dewberry, that's the seeds are in the fruit, right? Mm-hmm. But then it's kind of cool, some of the other ones, too. Like Carolina cranesbill is a cool one. It has that long, sharp kind of seed head.
And that
thing.
One, if you touch it when it's just right, the seeds will kind of shoot out of there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the vetch and the clovers are legumes, and they have those kind of bean pod things, right?
Mm-hmm. Those are another one to watch slowly over time because a lot of beans, it's the humidity that dries out the pod, and they kind of stretch and tear themselves open and kind of release those seeds out. So it's fun to watch. If you're into art, it's very artistic the way some of these fruits open And botanists, of course, if you really want to get into it, they have names for all these things, right? Is it dehiscent, indehiscent? You know, they got all these names for the fruits. And just get a hold of me and we'll go searching through my little, you know, picture definition book to figure out what it is.
I'll take you up on that.
Okay,
a really
great.
Technical social media post coming up on a seed head.
Snooze fest.
I think I'm really educated all of a sudden.
Great. Well, this has been a great discussion. Thanks, Mark. Thanks, Ivy, for joining us on Coast to Canopy.
Thanks for you guys for participating in NOMO March.
Thanks for being here.
Yeah.
You can watch the video version of Coast to Canopy at wfsu.org/ecologyblog and the WFSU Ecology YouTube channel. During this episode, Mark talked about exploring ecosystems near you to help you learn your own home landscape. You can start that journey on the Ecology blog. We also have a lot of content on gardening for wildlife. Again, wfsu.org/ecologyblog. All of those videos, podcast episodes, and blog posts are made possible with support from viewers and listeners like you. WFSU is both an NPR and PBS station, and we can't serve our community without your support. For a $10 a month pledge, I'll give you a shout out on this podcast, like right now. Thank you to David Blair, Carol Goodyear, Veronica Humphrey, Lisa Johnson, Chris McFarland, Carrie Maddox, Clara Mullins, Alina Pryor, Dylan Riles Hamilton, Thomas and Helen Roth, Kim Sash, and Donna Tharp. We've also had several smaller donations, and any amount helps. You can join the Seed Circle at wfsu.org/ecologyblog. This has been Coast to Canopy, an ecology podcast from WFSU Public Media. Today we had Taylor Cox running audio and Jason Acuna directing video. Lydell Rawls provided the Lake Jackson photos at the start of the video version. And I am your host and producer of all things ecology at WFSU, Rob Diaz de Villegas.